Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Okay, we're turning our attention to England at the World Cup. They're up against Nigeria this evening in an international friendly in the preparation for Russia 2018. And I'm delighted to say that Danny Mills joins us on the line. Now, Danny, we're going to chat about England and how they're going to get on at this World Cup. But it's impossible to speak about this team, especially this week, without speaking about Raheem Sterling. And it's really a story as old as time itself that we're now talking about the media scrutiny around England rather than the England team itself, aren't we?
And I think that's always been the case. I think when England players in the past have moaned about the pressures from the media and the media intrusion, that's not always been the case. I don't think there is extra pressure from the media to go out and perform. But I think what we have seen this week is, you know, when players are appearing on the front page for what I see as absolute nonsense, for a tattoo, which has very, very special meaning to him, is unfinished. He has his own personal reasons for it. You know, why is this on the front page? You know, you have people demanding that he should be dropped from the England squad, demanding that he should have it covered up. I mean, have we been through all David Beckham's tattoos, Brad Pitt's tattoos, Angelina Jolie, whoever it is? You know, do we go, rock stars? Do we look at all their tattoos and say, oh, this is ridiculous? You know, there's a knife on it. Well, that might encourage knife crime. It just seems a bizarre world that we live in, and people are desperate to complain about something as soon as possible.
Yeah, I don't think really it's Saturday at this point. We shouldn't really be entertaining the people reporting this any further than that, Danny. But I do want to ask you about the impact that this may have, because it seems that the squad have really rallied around Raheem Sterling over the past few days, and in a strange way, this whole thing could turn into a positive in terms of team building.
Well, it can sometimes turn into a siege mentality. Mm. I think that happened, I think it was before, was it Italia 90? I think obviously Bobby Robson was in charge at the time. And the England players almost refused to speak to the media. And just went, no, we're not going to speak to the media. We're getting criticised for this, criticised for that. You know, whatever they did, you know, they were wrong. And they just said, right, okay, you know, this is now going to be siege mentality. You know, we are in this together. And this is the problem. The media always complain about players don't want to speak to the media and they don't want to get involved. And then they wonder why, when they're putting players on the front pages for meaningless nonsense all the time, that it's got nothing to do with football whatsoever. But I think it will. I mean, Gareth is a very intelligent lad. You know, he's very, very media savvy. He's very, very good with the younger players and the younger generation in understanding their needs. How life has changed, especially in this world of social media that we live in. He's exceptional at that. And he will bring all the guys together. And he will make it happen that actually, you know what, lads? You know, ignore everything that's going on. We're together. You know, we're a team. We're a squad. You know, we fight this on a united front. And you're quite right. It could bring the players together in a positive way. It's just a shame that it has to come from such a negative.
Yeah, for sure. Like, you mentioned Gareth Southgate there and what he's done and how savvy he is in terms of team management with regards to the players as humans. And one of the things he's been speaking about this week is in terms of breaking down the barriers between certain cliques that might exist within a squad. Like, is this a normal thing in an England squad to have so many cliques around a panel? Like, I'm not sure what your experience was in 2002. Did it feel like you were alienated from certain players and had your specific friends that you would always spend your time with in camp?
Alienated, no. Have your specific groups of friends, of course. And that's always happened, no matter what, no matter who you work for, where you go. If you work for an organisation and then you go and meet up with another organisation and you have a meal that night, you're going to go and sit with the people that you know. You know, when I was in the England squad, Nigel Martin was my roommate at Leeds. We roomed together. So when we went away with England, we sat together. And the Leeds guys, you know, we'd been together. The Man United lads sat together. They knew each other. You know, they were friends. The Liverpool lads sat together. They were friends. The Arsenal lads sat together. It has changed a little bit because players do tend to move around a little bit more. They do know each other, possibly a little bit different from other clubs. There has always been, they're not cliques to a point. You know, there are always different friendship groups. You know, and that's no different. You know, if you're having a supermarket, you know, a national supermarket day out where Morrison's, Aldi, Marks and Spencer's, Waitrose all joined together for a night out. You just stay with the people that you know. It's just basic. Whether it might be radio shows. If all the radio teams in Ireland went out for a night out, you wouldn't just go and, oh, actually, I'm going to ignore all my friends and go and speak to somebody else. So I think that is, again, it's over-exaggerated at times. I don't think, you know, that's always the reason for it. But again, it's the media trying to pick up on any little thing that they possibly can to try and, it seems sometimes, to try and disrupt things.
Yeah, well, you're right there. We definitely wouldn't sit with our competitors at any sort of social gathering whatsoever. So you're right on that one. But in terms of the 2002 situation there, like, it is natural that you say people from different clubs will sit with one another and stuff like that. But with regards to Manchester United players sitting together, for example, or spending a lot of time together, I presume there had to have been an effort on their part, given their seniority within the camp, the likes of David Beckham, the likes of Paul Scholes, to try and integrate players like you into more of their social setting, even around the 2002 World Cup.
Yeah, but again, that's no different from club hierarchy. You know, you get on the bus as a young player, and you know, there are only certain seats you can sit in, because the senior players, that's their seat, that's their table. You know, it's what they do. Same at the dinner table, you know, that the captain has seniority. England was no different from that. You know, you had the inner circle, what I would call the senior group of players that have been there, done it, that talk to the manager, that will talk to the manager, have influence on the manager about actually how the players are feeling. Do they want to train? Do they want to train somewhere different? Do they need a day off? Do they need a different meal? Do they need to go out and play golf and just get away? It's no different from talking to your captain and your senior players at club level. You know, there's a hierarchy, you know, throughout. And you have to, you learn to deal with that. You won't always be the youngest. You won't always be, you know, the least experienced player in the camp. And it's no different from going into a club being an apprentice. You start at the bottom of the ladder, or any walk of life. You know, you start at the bottom and you work your way up, and that's how I see it. It's pretty much common sense as I see it.
Yeah. So I mentioned 2002 there. Just been looking back through some of the results there, watching a couple of videos this morning, Danny, and I wonder if it's fair to say at this point in hindsight, or maybe in the immediate hindsight, that the 2002 World Cup, from an England perspective, could be viewed as one of the ones that got away.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we had dreams and aspirations of suddenly getting to the quarterfinals, thinking, you know what, if we beat Brazil, we could win this. You know, if we can beat these, there's no reason. Obviously, we went 1-0 up, and then we conceded just before half time. And you look back, and people say, do you have regrets? Personally, no. I think I gave absolutely everything in that tournament. On a personal level, proved a lot of people wrong. People that didn't think I was good enough to play at that level. People that didn't think I would be disciplined enough to play at that level. I think possibly the only regret that maybe we did have as a team in the last 15, 20 minutes, we didn't mix it up a little bit and say, you know what, let's just shell a few balls into the box. You know, let's go old school Ireland, if you like. Mm. You know, let's put the big man up front, stick a few balls in and see what happens. I think maybe we were too tired. Maybe we, you know, had a tough game. Brazil had kept the ball off us. They were better than us. But that's probably the only thing that we didn't really do in that last sort of 10, 15 minutes was do something different. You know, and it's not pretty, but sometimes, you know, you just shell a few balls into the box, keeper might spill one, you might get a header, something like that. So, no, I think no real regrets. It's an opportunity. But I think 2006, just after that as well, is the last time England got to the quarterfinals. So, you know, what was supposed to be the golden generation, I often say, was the golden plated generation. And when you scratch the surface, you know, there wasn't an awful lot of brilliance underneath that.
Yeah, because you had to navigate an incredibly tough group. I presume it was referred to as the group of death at the time. I can't really recall, but like Argentina, Nigeria and Sweden in your group, famously, of course, beating the tournament favourites in Argentina that day. Like, surely at that point, once you've beaten the tournament favourites, you're looking around to yourselves in the dressing room thinking, right, we can go all the way here.
Yeah, you do. And you sort of, I mean, that was a huge game for us. We had to beat Argentina to qualify, really. If not, we knew we'd have to go into the Nigeria game to win. Obviously, we beat Argentina. Michael Owen, as we all know, sort of went down for a penalty. We got it. We'll take that. You know, we complain about diving when it suits. But on that occasion, you know, we're all quite happy to accept that it was clearly a penalty. And then we did. We went on and we battered Denmark in the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 3-0 up. Relatively easy and comfortable game. in all honesty. And it was, and looking at it, and you start to have bizarre dreams as a kid. You know, for me, from being on nowhere near the World Cup squad and being on the fringes to suddenly playing, starting, getting to a quarter final, playing against some of the best players on the planet at that time. You know, Ronaldo, Roberto Carlos, Cafu, Ronaldinho, Rivaldo. Just insane. And you're thinking, if we can beat these, there's no reason why we can't win the World Cup. Imagine if we win the World Cup. We might all go home and get knighted. You know, I might be 25 years old and be Sir Danny. You know, and you have these sort of bizarre thoughts. But obviously, you know, like I said, Brazil were just better than us, really. The quality that they had, and it wasn't to be.
Are you having those thoughts in the game when you're actually up against Rivaldo and Ronaldinho? Are you thinking about potentially becoming Sir Danny Mills?
No. I mean, that's almost like a flippant moment's thought that you have. Because as a kid, you dream. And for me, you know, dreaming of playing in the World Cups and those sort of things is just insane. And you get to it, and you suddenly, there is that moment where you think, oh, I know Brazil, best team in the tournament left. If we beat them, we could beat everybody. We could win the World Cup. And of course, you have those dreams and aspirations. But it's not realistic. I mean, in the game for me, my first and foremost job was to stop Roberto Carlos.
Yeah.
That was it. You know, in my head, focus, do not get beaten one-on-one by Carlos. And it was tough. But I had a decent game that day. I did my job pretty much to the best that I could. It was a good battle, one that I enjoyed and thrived on it. But no, you're so focused. It is so intense once that whistle goes that you have no other thought at all apart from doing your job in that moment.
It surely helped as well going into that matchup with Roberto Carlos that day, given what had happened in the previous four games, only conceding one goal, Thomas Gravesen describing you after the Denmark game as like a brick wall, that defence was impossible to penetrate. Like very night and day, if you compare the attitudes towards Danny Mills at that point to the way the press and the way the public, I'd imagine, described you before the tournament when Gary Neville went out injured.
Oh, incredible. I mean, I'd had a really bad season, disciplinary-wise. I played pretty well that season. But I had two red cards, 14 yellows and an FA ban. David O'Leary had absolutely slaughtered me a week before the World Cup. Did a double page spread in Red Top Nationals, saying that if he ever has a season like this again, he'll never play for Leeds again under me. He actually got sacked shortly afterwards. But, you know, you don't need that sort of extra pressure going into it. I think I only ever got booked once. But, you know, when you talk about the cliques that go on, I played Rio Ferdinand. I was right back. Rio was right-sided centre-half. Ashley Cole, Sol Campbell, the left-sided pairing of that, obviously David Seaman, the goal from Arsenal. We did a training session very, very early on, and a situation happened. Me and Rio both went towards the ball, and Sol and Ashley dropped off and went the other way. And there was this sort of 30-yard chasm of your defence being split right down the middle. Two had gone forward, two had gone back. And, of course, you can't have that. Mm. You know, it was all over the shop. And Steve McLaren just pulled us in and said, look, lads, there's the video. This is what happened. Now, we need to work out what we're going to do. So, we turned around, we had a chat, we sat down, like, OK, from now on, this is what we do. We went out and worked on it, and we did it. You know, we discussed it. We discussed football like adults. So, you know, how different types of players that suddenly learn to deal with a different situation, lo and behold, by talking to each other, and discussing it. It's amazing. You know, it's amazing what a little bit of chat can do and a little bit of talking.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I guess, like, Steve McLaren is lauded for that role under Sven-Goran Eriksson at the time, and that just shows the mature level he had to coaching.
I still would say, I didn't always see eye to eye with Steve McLaren as a manager when I had him at Middlesbrough. But he's one of the best coaches around. He's absolutely exceptional. In fact, just at the end of the season, when I knew that he was available and there was a sniff of the QPR job that he might be getting, I spoke to a couple of my very good friends at Leeds United and said, look, if McLaren's available, you could do an awful lot worse than get him in. Put a technical director or a sporting director above him, but he is one of the best coaches I've ever worked with, and you couldn't go far wrong. They ignored that and he's gone to QPR. But that's about coaching, talking to players, understanding what they want. And that's what you have to do. You know, you all have slightly different roles at your clubs. You all have slightly different ways of playing. But internationally, you've got to come together. And I think that's where Gareth will be very, very good. Mm. I mean, he will sit down with the players, talk to them, and he's quite happy to give them a voice and say, look, lads, what do you want? Because there's no, if you're a dictator, and we've seen that in the past, this is what you do. This is how you play. And the players aren't either comfortable with it, or it's not really what they want to do, or they're not, you know, really enamoured or happy with it. You're not going to get that level of performance. So, you know, there are times when you have to do that, of course. But ultimately, you sit down with the players and you discuss the best way forward. And that's about good man management.
Yeah, you mentioned there, and we will talk about this England team again in just a moment, but you mentioned there earlier on about your disciplinary record going into the World Cup. When you think about it, though, from this point of view, it is not an entire negative when you really think about it, because England needed that edge at the time. It was kind of something they might have had over this Brazilian team, who, like Rivaldo, was well renowned for some of the things he did in that 2002 World Cup, particularly in that game against Turkey. So you had a bit of an edge yourself, but you also had some quick thinking. I mean, when Ronaldinho gets sent off in that World Cup quarter final, Paul Scholes, I understand, and yourself
ever. Should have been two red cards. No, I'm only kidding. It wasn't. No, but it was just common sense. You know, you get kicked. And I think I think it might be Scholes he ran over and just said, "Oh, the referee's got getting a card out. Stay down." I didn't roll around screaming. You know, I wasn't waving my arms in the air like I'd been shot or I'd been sort of, you know, chopped in half. Mm. I just stayed down, and then you let the referee make the decision. You know, that's it. Simple. People always say, "Oh, it's the wrong thing to do. You shouldn't teach kids that." I wasn't trying to teach kids anything. In the World Cup, I was trying to win the World Cup. Mm. And this is where I think people often get it wrong. When you play sport at the highest level, whatever sport you do, you are there to win. And you are there to win at all costs, no matter what. And you do anything to win. Now, is that the right way to teach kids? No. But ultimately, these kids are not going to get to this stage. They're not going to be playing, you know, in this environment, in a World Cup, you know, where winning is everything. So, you know, I do always find that a little bit strange. But, yeah, I did have an edge. I did what I was good at. I made the best of my ability to do what I could. You know, I think it was the first tackle against Roberto Carlos. He picked the ball up about 10 yards away. I just sort of looked at him and I thought, oh, God, he's gonna knock this past me and it's just going to be a race. And it was. Sort of returned, sprinting. I got a big tackle in. You know, the ball bounced up. We had another tackle. Two or three tackles in the first 10 to 15 minutes. He didn't get past me. And you suddenly start to go, oh, I can match him now. Yeah. I can compete with Roberto Carlos. I'm doing all right. And that gives you a massive boost in confidence. And that should be about being prepared. You know, knowing what his strengths are, knowing what his possible weaknesses are, and being prepared for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you mentioned, the confidence boost, and I'd imagine once the disappointment of that defeat dies down over the following weeks, like you listen to some of Sven's comments after the game saying that you guys weren't good enough on the day, but you will be. Like after that, after your own performance throughout the tournament, you must have thought to yourself, right, okay, I'm going to come very close to winning a World Cup with England one day. It's going to happen eventually. And it just didn't materialise.
And then Gary Neville got fit and I got dropped. Very, very, very quickly, like a lead balloon. I disappeared from the scene, and I think then that was what was disappointing. I think for me, I had a very, very good World Cup. We played Portugal in a pre-season friendly, or you know that early season game. I think we played them at Villa Park. I played quite well. I think obviously Ronaldo and Figo played in that game, did well in that. And then I think we went away somewhere. I think Gary Neville had played like three games at Man United, and he put him straight back in the side. You know, after being out for a long, long time. And I just knew from that point, however well I played, and Sven had obviously said even to myself and the press that he was really pleased, and I played very, very well. But Gary was fit, he played. And then that sort of was tough to take, really, because I had to suddenly realise no matter how well I played, no matter what I'd done, probably wasn't going to be good enough to get ahead of Gary Neville for whatever reason.
Do you think that the current England manager in Gareth Southgate operates off a similar level at all? It seems to me that he operates off more of a meritocracy, really, that the player in form is going to start the first game of the World Cup.
No, Gareth's a good friend of mine. I had breakfast with him the other morning. We were just having a chat about, lots of different things. You know, our kids are the same age and all that sort of stuff. We had a little bit of chat about football. We try not to overdo the football talk because I try not to, you know, he gets that enough from everywhere else. But no, he is. He's quite happy. You know, he knows. He got an awful lot of stick when he put Kyle Walker in at centre-half against Holland. But he knew full well that he'd seen it in the past. And I said, I did the commentary at the time. I'd moved in and played as part of a three under Glenn Hoddle for England in the 21s. Carragher's done it. Gary Neville had done it. It's a lot easier. Aspilicueta's done it very, very well. It's a lot easier for a fullback to tuck inside. And he just described, said, well, look, you know, I move him inside. Trippier's probably got better delivery in the final third. Kyle's a fantastic athlete and a decent defender. And he can use him going forward. And it worked. So, no, Gareth is very much, he will pick the team that he needs. And it will be on form. It's not going to be on reputation. And I think we've seen that already. And I think what is interesting, when people say, the squad isn't very experienced. And Gareth knows that, but he says, "Look, you only ever get experience by having the experience. So you've got to go through that process to get good at what you do and to get better." But he also knows that a lot of those experiences from those senior players are actually bad experiences, and they can be a little bit of a burden. So he's trying to brush all that away and give this new generation a fresh start.
And do you get the sense that that's the same thing with Gareth himself, that he's also free of burden, particularly when it comes to the England managerial role? So do you feel he'll be almost, not carefree, but he'll be a little bit more kind of sprightly than previous managers, for example?
Yeah, I love the way he deals with the press. I mean, it's brilliant at times. You know. And he'll say to the players, look, lads, doesn't get worse than missing a penalty in a semi-final. Yeah. He said, you are vilified, you are hated. He said, trust me, I've been through it. I've been at the worst ebb you can possibly be at for an England player. He said, it doesn't get worse, you know, simple as that. And he was a young man at the time, so he understands all the pressures and everything that comes with it. But the way he deals with the press sometimes, I think I see him sat there, and I also almost see him chuckle and sort of just think to himself, that's a really stupid question. And he can see him process it. And again, a great example, when they talked about James Milner being in the England squad, they said, James Milner's had a fantastic season, brilliant in the Champions League, ran off all his stats and went, obviously, but he has retired from international football. But did you think about bringing him back? And he just paused and went, haven't you just answered your own question? He's retired from international football. So this question that lasts about 3 minutes, he just cut this, you know, and And he's good like that. And the shoulders almost sort of jiggled a little bit. And you can see him just going, that was a bit daft, wasn't it? And I think that's what he's good at. You know, he's very, very malleable with the press. He's happy to deal with them, happy to speak to them. Very, very considered in his thinking. And he's open and honest with them.
Yeah.
It was very much still, I think, you know, that new generation of manager that's been through that. Frank Lampard, I think, is a perfect example. When they said to Frank, you've been looking at players, you went to the League Two playoff final. Is that the sort of players you're looking to buy for Derby County? And he just flipped it around and said, well, I'm also going to the World Cup. Does that mean I'm going to try and sign Messi? and this is what Gareth's having to deal with on a day-to-day basis. You know, he goes to watch a game and it's in the press. You've been watching so-and-so. He's been watching this person. This person's in his thoughts. And he's like, no one's got a clue. So he's not. No one. He said, no one knows who I'm watching or why I'm there. I might just turn up for a game.
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, the press always makes something of it. So he's very, very good, and he's got to the stage going, you know what? You can write what you want, say what you like. He's very, very comfortable in himself and quite happy to be his own man.
So how do you see it going, Danny? I mean, in a long-term goal basis, like, looking at it from my perspective, it seems that it is highly likely that England will make it to the quarterfinals and then come up against either a Germany or Brazil. And I guess
quarterfinals would be a really good result.
Yeah,
if I'm honest, you expect them to get out of the group with it. It's an easy group, and the way the fixtures fall, the two easiest games first. to expect them to get out of the group. Round of 16, you never know. You need a little bit of luck. There can always be a disaster, which can be nothing to do with players or managers. It can be a slip or a bad refereeing decision. VAR could be an absolute nightmare, you know, this time around. But I think the quarterfinals would be a really good achievement. And when you look at the German side that won it, obviously, and when you would go through their record, it was like quarterfinal, semi-final, final, semi-final, quarterfinal, final. You know, these players, they were chipped away, and their younger generations have been doing exactly the same thing. So they were used to getting to the latter stages of tournaments. So, you know, and that's what you've got to do. So it's a great opportunity for this young England team to go there, play with some freedom, play in a new kind of style, and let's hope they get to the quarterfinals, and who knows.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating stuff. Danny, thank you so much for your time. You're very generous with it. No, we'll chat to you again soon.
You can thank Kevin Kilbane for that.
Will do. Thanks a million, Danny.
Not a problem. Take care.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.